3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Baby. 3CR's summer programming. This summer, 3CR Breakfast is featuring extended special event recordings and selected interview highlights from the past year, as well as new summer culture or music-themed breakfast shows curated by our current affairs breakfast teams. Stay tuned to 3CR, and we look forward to returning to our regular programming in January.
Good morning, this is Marty from Wednesday Breakfast. You're on 3CR and our summer programming. We'll be back with regular 3CR programming later in the month. This morning, first up, we have an interview that ran in early October, with Sarah Salah, who is a writer, poet, a human rights lawyer and a refugee advocate. Sarah was among a delegation of people that attended a press conference in Parliament House in Canberra early in October. The People United Against Genocide. Sarah was there alongside members of the Greens, independent members of Parliament, academics, and doctors and others, all calling for long overdue sanctions against Israel.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for making some time. I know it was a very busy day for you yesterday. You're based in Sydney. You're in Canberra for the day. Could you firstly just give us a little bit of your own background and what I suppose drew you to be part of the of this group, the People United Against Genocide?
Absolutely. So, as a writer and an organizer for the Palestine Justice Movement, longtime organizer, I think for me it was really crucial to be part of this coalition, to go to Parliament, to speak to our politicians, to speak to our media, right in, as Senator Thorpe calls it, colonial headquarters, to let them know that we are not and won't ever be silent on what is happening in Gaza at the moment. And so for me, as someone who is involved in the movement, who has been organizing with communities for a very long time and, you know, in conversation with them, understanding the current moment, understanding the grief that so many of us carry, the loss, but also the resolve, the steadfastness to keep moving forward and to keep doing what needs to be done, because there is no other alternative and because the people of Gaza demand. So I think that's sort of the context in which we were going.
Could you tell us some of the other people that joined you yesterday, some of the other people that have gotten behind the movement? And was sharing the message, as you say, with media yesterday, and trying to, you know, get basically in the face, I suppose, of politicians, and to share this message. Who were some of those other people that you're working with?
Yes, that's right. So given that it was a coalition of groups across the country, but mainly coming from Sydney, so Gadigal and Narm Melbourne, we had a range of speakers, including a medical mission, so doctors, healthcare workers. We had teachers and unionists. We had scholars. We had activists. We had writers and poets. And we also had, of course, three very staunch senators, and that's Senator Mehreen Farooqi, Senator Lydia Thorpe, and Senator Fatima Payman. So we were all there as part of that coalition, speaking to what is happening in Gaza and in Lebanon at the moment, Palestine and Lebanon, and doing so from the perspective of, you know, understanding that what is happening is a humanitarian crisis. And so we got to hear from Dr. Bushra Othman, who is a phenomenal doctor who recently went to Gaza as the first Australian female surgeon and was part of this, you know, the team there, the mission there, and spoke to some of the harrowing things that she, of course, saw on the ground. and then was able, you know, to use that to say that healthcare workers and hospitals are not a target, even though we have seen time and again massacres in hospitals. We've seen that Israel has crossed the line. There are no red lines for Israel. They've committed war crimes so brazenly. And Bushra, as a doctor, was there and was able to give her perspective on that. And so that was one of the, I think, the most powerful coming out of the delegation who were there yesterday. I think the other really important perspective we heard was from a teacher who also is a friend of one of the aid workers who was very tragically killed during an Israeli airstrike. And she was able to speak, so this is the Australian aid worker, Zomi Franklin, and so she was able to speak to that as well and to say that aid workers are also not a target and that we need to be, you know, Israel cannot keep doing this with impunity. Our government needs to do more, take more action to hold Israel to account. As a matter of fact, the international community needs to do so. And so ultimately, I think what, you know, the core message of the entire delegation, regardless of the, you know, the various perspectives we were coming from, was that our government is complicit. Our government is, you know, sponsoring a genocide via sending military aid, weapons, you know, dollars to Israel as along with Western governments. So we are complicit. We are sponsoring the genocide. We need to do more. Ceasefire is not enough. We need sanctions and we need an arms embargo.
It's 7:45. You're listening to 3CR. We're speaking with Sara Saleh, who was in Canberra yesterday, part of this delegation of people. Sara's a writer, a human rights lawyer, was joined by a very powerful group of people, I suppose you could say, really, for this press conference. Sara, could you just explain, before we move on to some of what you personally spoke about in Canberra, just the sort of the mood around the press conference? You mentioned a moment ago that Independent Member Lydia Thorpe, Fatima Payman, Maureen Faruqi, they were all part of the press conference with you. What was the sort of the mood around that press conference? Because it went for quite some time. It was very powerful.
I think it was a very somber mood in the sense that everyone was obviously quite emotional because of the fact that we are marking, of course, the 1 year since this genocide started. And so as part of an ongoing month of action, which was organized by APAN and a cross-section of Palestine organizations across the country, as part of this month of action, we were there to, as I said, relay the message that Gaza is, you know, front of mind at the moment and that our government is not doing enough. So, of course, people, you know, were quite emotional. Mm. I think hearing from the doctors in particular moved everyone, but also very, you know, very staunch and resolved. Hearing from Senator Payman, for example, who was really adamant that we keep our focus on Gaza, and also hearing from Senator Lydia Thorpe, who is very, as a staunch black woman in Parliament, I'm sure that she has to endure the sort of violence that she speaks about on the daily. And so having her there, having her presence there, reminding us that we are fighting genocides, you know, from this land, this continent to Palestine, is an intersectional connected fight. I think that was really important because for us as well, it's fuel, you know, it nourishes us, it energizes us, it reminds us why we're here and what we're doing.
Yes. Dr. Bushra Othman, who you've referred to there, extraordinary person, and listeners can also go back and hear her accounts from her time in Palestine. She was in the 3CR studios about 3 months ago, just after she returned. Extraordinary stories. Now, you also addressed some of the local impacts, I suppose we could say the widening impacts, things that we've seen become more apparent across Australian society, particularly in recent weeks, that are a direct result of what's taking place in the Middle East. Can you just speak to some of what you talked about in relation to that and that local impacts that we're seeing here?
That's right. So I did speak a little bit to Australia's role in maintaining, you know, the status quo and maintaining what is happening on the ground in Palestine and the violence that we're seeing Palestinians be subjected to in Gaza and across the West Bank. But I think what I really wanted to do was also bring it back home and reflect on sort of the broader strategy of repression that we are seeing take place across, you know, the movement in Australia. And part of that is the fact that we are seeing the repression of people who are speaking out for Palestine. So we're seeing, you know, students be suspended. We're seeing activists and public figures be attacked and targeted and punished, you know, in media and so on. We're seeing government, particularly, you know, specific politicians, misuse their platforms and sort of use that to target and smear not only advocacy organizations, but also individuals, again, who are speaking out for the rights of Palestinians. And one example of that is the very heavily politicized Senate inquiry that came out a couple of, the hearing was a couple of weeks ago now, the Senate inquiry into anti-Semitism on campuses, which has quite clearly got an agenda of conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism as a bid to shut down any legitimate political critique of Israel and what Israel is doing in Gaza and beyond at the moment. And so we are seeing this across the board, as I said, and it is certainly very worrying for us because we know that it is a concerted effort to shut down anyone who is speaking for Palestine, and that is something that we need to really contend with and push back against.
Well, I suppose we've been seeing it again just recently, most recently, just weeks ago, with governments of, I suppose, various persuasions even making efforts to have gatherings shut down, protests shut down.
That's exactly right. I mean, you have MINs in New South Wales using policies, trying to use judiciary. You know, they took us to court. Now they're claiming logistical issues, aka that we are costing the state and therefore shouldn't have the right to protest. Which is a very interesting angle, I would say, because there's an easy solution to that, and that is send less cops. For a year, we have had almost what I would say is the majority, 99% of our protests be peaceful, be successful, yes, be very well attended, be, you know, be community-led and marshaled. And so we actually don't need cops. As a matter of fact, having their presence there is agitating and more likely to lead to violence, let's be honest. And so I think for us, whilst we have managed, and as I said, it's been peaceful and very safe, and community is there for one reason only, and everything else is a distraction. I think there is an easy solution. It is to have less cops. It's also to, as I think Lydia Shelley, who is the head of the Civil Liberties Council in New South Wales, said, if we are to put a tier, if we are to say that it's expensive and only that means that we are suggesting that only people who are wealthy or have enough resources should have the right to protest. Mm. And that's obviously unacceptable.
Well, as I said a moment ago, it was a powerful day. I'm sure you felt that yesterday. There was also people that travelled from far distances as well to join that cause on the lawn. There was a lot of discussion inside the parliament. There was the members of the Greens were holding up signs in parliament yesterday. It was a very across the board sort of feeling yesterday, and it must have been heartening as well to see some of those people outside on the lawns.
Definitely. I think I do want to very quickly acknowledge Senator Mehreen Farooqi as well, who, as mentioned earlier, was one of the speakers, the main, you know, who led us into the conference inside, the press conference inside. And I think when we were contending with very unfortunate lines of questioning from elements of the media, she definitely did not hold back. And when we get questions, after spending 45 minutes pouring our hearts out, talking about and remaining focused on Gaza and the people there and what is happening there, and, you know, what we need to be done, what we need to see at the moment to get justice for Palestine. 45 minutes and some elements of the media still choose to frame it in terms of self-defense and, you know, put the parameters around Israel and Israel's right to exist and Israel's right to self-defense. And I think that is exactly the root of the problem, that time and again, we are trying to shift the discourse and ask for a more honest and more, you know, more intellectually honest, more good faith conversation about what is happening so that we can actually end the violence once and for all. We need to understand the root of it. We need to be honest about it. And we need to be discerning and willing to have hard conversations, no matter how difficult that is, because of the fact that there may be repercussions to media by certain elements of Israel lobby or by government. Whatever the reason, the media's job is, one would hope, is to you know, tell the full story. And I think yesterday it was clear that that is not what is happening. And so Mehreen, Senator Farouki, responded saying that it is astounding that 100,000 people have been murdered, 100,000 plus, 20,000 babies have been killed. And how is that self-defense? How are we still believing these lines and not being critical, not being honest about it? And so I really want to shout out hearing Senator Farouki just respond to that question with, you know, such eloquence and such passion, and just honor the people in Gaza was very heartening to me personally. And then to go outside and see the gatherings on the front lawns, the relentlessness, the energy of everyone showing up for Gaza, that everyone, you know, from all various backgrounds, from all various geographies and walks of life, showing up and being there, committed and disciplined for justice, for peace, for equality, for Gaza. That to me is the future right there.
Indeed. And while later in the day some politicians inside the house were barking over the and quibbling over words of emotion, I think the real story was what you and your friends and colleagues and people from the People United Against Genocide movement were talking about.
That is absolutely right. Spot on, Martin. Thank you.
You're on 3CR. This is our summer programming, and we'll go to a track. This is Julia Boutros with Resistant. You're listening to 3CR's summer programming. This next interview was first aired on Wednesday Breakfast in late October. It's an interview with researcher Tim Brightus, who is also co-host of the excellent People's History of Australia podcast, which specialises in moments when ordinary people across Australia made history. In this interview, Tim is speaking to us specifically about student activism.
Thanks so much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to talk to everyone. So my previous research was a PhD at the University of Sydney, and it's entitled Education for Liberation, Not for World Domination. Hopefully a funny title. I was trying to entertain my markers with that one. And basically the idea was to focus on protest from 85 to 2006 in Australia, and kind of countering the erasure of student protests in that period from the historical record. Like when you go to the actual sources, like student newspapers and like people's personal collections, and I did a lot of oral histories. I think I did 65 oral histories.
72. I just read this yesterday.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I've forgotten. One of my embarrassing traits as a historian is I'm not very good with numbers or dates, but I kind of get the general ballpark. Yeah, so 72. Stand corrected. So basically when you go to the sources, you find out that there was an incredible array of student protest across Australia, across this continent. There were protests of, 5,000 to 6,000 people with regularity in WA, in the East Coast, even in Tasmania. Little Tasmania had a 6,000-strong protest against the Labor Party conference in the late 80s. Again, WA kind of thought of as this really conservative state, but it actually had the largest boycott of student fees of the HEAC, the Higher Education Administrative Charge, at Curtin University in the late 80s. So that was an incredible campaign, which is almost entirely forgotten about. And WA also had really big protests against the voluntary student union legislation in the early 90s. It kind of produced people like...
Perhaps just explain what the voluntary student union legislation is, because I suspect that a lot, particularly of our younger listeners, just take for granted the landscape we have at the moment.
Yeah, that's a great point. So voluntary student unionism was basically this project by the Liberals to cut funding to student activism. So previously, students, when they went to university, had to pay, had compulsory fees to student unions. So it meant, and it might have been like a couple of $100 kind of thing. So it was a decent amount, but it was worth it because it meant that student unions were well funded, like for things like sports and societies, but also for political activism. And it meant that students like were represented on campus. And also the student unions were a real source of transmitting knowledge, like, down generations of activists. So, like, the paid office bearer, you know, who produces zine could do run a political education workshop, and, like, knowledge will be passed down from activist to activist. And that's really important in a university when, you know, you have a limited lifespan of an activist, like, you're only at uni for a couple of years. So that transmission of knowledge was really important with the student unionism. And so the Liberals, like, tried to roll out voluntary student unionism across the states and then on a federal level. So WA was the first cab off the rank. Go WA. And it had a really extreme voluntary student union legislation. And Victoria followed shortly afterwards under the Jeff Kennett government, the Liberal government, in the early to mid-90s. And then it was rolled out on a federal level by the Howard government in the mid-2000s. And the WA VSU, the more extreme one, basically became a model for the Howard government in Victoria. It's kind of a complicated story. I get into it in my thesis. But basically, like, activism against it was quite successful. And although VSU did come in on a state level, they beat back some of the worst effects, and then were still able to organise quite effectively despite the fact that there was VSU. Yeah.
Now, one of the sort of overarching stories that we know, in inverted commas, about student activism is that there was this surge in the 60s, and then people became more self-interested and people weren't that political, and young people today, they're so apathetic, yeah. Things like that. What do the archives say, and what do you think that story, what's the purpose of telling that story, of downplaying the activism of students in the 90s and early 2000s?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That was kind of really central to my thesis, this like romanticization of the 60s period and a kind of dismissal of everything else. You know, like there's this common saying in history books, like that it was the biggest rally since the Vietnam moratoriums, you know, nothing could possibly be bigger or more radical than the Vietnam moratoriums. So I kind of think that like the history of the 60s is used as a weapon against activists of today. Like it kind of says that, you know, activism can only happen in this period. And I was trying to counter that. I was trying to say that activism isn't confined to it. And I'm kind of like pushing back against the historiography, the broader history literature to some extent. Like I think if you read a general Australian history book, basically the 60s and 70s are the protest chapters. Like, and there's nothing else on protest in the entire rest of the book. I could name names. I won't. These are, you know, these are like colleagues and stuff. But yeah, like I think that's something I really wanted to push back against. I wanted to say that protest is happening all the time in Australian history. It's this really strong current. There's a current of defiance. There's a current of resistance. There's a current of collective action. So that's kind of what I was going for. Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously right now we're experiencing quite a upsurge in student protest on campuses, and also of repression of student protest on campuses as well. Is there a difference between the activism of young people today? And obviously, I'm thinking about the Palestine protests, well, the protests against the genocide that's going on in Palestine, compared to with the period that you're studying, at least in your thesis. And what do you think might be the drivers of any differences that exist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there is a pretty big difference. Like, so the last upsurge of kind of anti-war, anti-imperialist activism was the Iraq War of 2003. And that saw the biggest mass protest in human history with, you know, 5 million, I can't remember the exact numbers, but millions of people going out in the streets across the world on the weekend of February 15th to 16th. This incredibly powerful moment that, you know, people thought was going to stop the war. And in Australia, you saw huge numbers as well. So the socialist newspaper Red Flag estimates that there were 250,000 people at the Sydney demo and 200,000 at the Melbourne demo. Like, the numbers are so big, it's almost impossible to calculate. But clearly there were, you know, enormous numbers of people on the streets. And these demonstrations, like, were bigger than the Palestine ones at their height. But the difference with Palestine today is that the activism is much more sustained. It's been, you know, we've had weekly rallies for a year, 52 weeks. And they're, like, pretty big week in, week out. Maybe 1,000 people. And then we saw the recent increase with the, like, horrifying aggression in Lebanon. So it's more sustained, whereas the Iraq war stuff, after they failed to stop the war from happening, people became demoralized and the numbers rapidly dwindled from the hundreds of thousands to, like, maybe the thousands. There was a real sense of disillusionment in the power of protest, I think. And, like, people thought that they were going to stop the war, really, like, passionately thought they were going to stop the war, but they didn't. So that's a big difference. So I think actually, like, the Vietnam era is maybe a slightly closer comparison to Palestine, in that there's with Vietnam, there was really sustained organizing over a period of years. Like, starting off small and then gradually getting bigger, like peaking in the moratoriums of 1970 and 71. And then obviously that did eventually help stop the war, like, alongside the incredible struggles of the Vietnamese people. The big difference between Vietnam and Palestine perhaps is that the conscription issue was really big in Vietnam. So there was this real personal cost for young men. Like, they thought they were going to have to fight and die. Shout out to, I just want to acknowledge, like, the first Australian conscript, Errol Nowak, who died in Vietnam, and then, like, hundreds of conscripts died in Vietnam in this horrifying war. And that was a real driver of the protest. But it's one of the successes of the Vietnam story, I think, is that it stopped conscription from being implemented ever again. Like, so one of the people I interviewed kind of argued that point quite hard. And, like, even though we've had wars, we have had conscription has been stopped by the Vietnam War protesters, and that kind of shows the power of protest. That was a long rave. I hope that was somewhat interesting. Yeah.
I'm also interested in the difference both in the response of the university authorities to what's happening today, I mean, particularly in contrast to what happened with Vietnam. But also, I mean, I feel that the shape of the university has changed so much. It's a barely recognisable institution in some way to what it was in the 70s, 80s. And that shift has been happening through the 90s and things. Do you think that there are differences as a result of the different institution that a university is today than it was?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not really sure. Like the campus I did my PhD at, Sydney Uni, has the campus access policy that's recently come in, which is a real attempt to, like, restrict protest on campus, as listeners might be aware of. Like, you basically have to ask permission for a protest, or even, I think, a poster, like, pretty extreme, or a stall, I believe. You know, every activist needs their stall. I have a friend who has their own personal stall. That sort of basic act of, you know, handing out leaflets, talking to people, is really the lifeblood of activism. So that's a pretty big deal. But, like, to be fair, there was like really extreme repression in the 60s and 70s as well. Like, so the state has always tried to clamp down on protests. University authorities have always tried to clamp down on protests. So like perhaps the strongest example from the 60s and 70s period is the La Trobe Three that folks might have heard of. Barry York, Fergus Robertson and Brian Poehler, who were all sent to Pentridge Prison in Melbourne, and like they were in, I think they were put in the maximum security ward for one bit or something. I can't remember the details. Don't quote me on that. But Barry York really vividly describes the experience on his website, and it just sounded absolutely horrible. And like they were in there for months, and there was a big campaign, and eventually they got out. Like partly due to the organising around that. There was also, university authorities suspended or expelled students. So a lot of the Monash radicals from that period were disciplined. In the University of Queensland, activists like Mitch Thompson was suspended. People were blacklisted from their jobs. So a young Queensland doctor who's now in Melbourne based, Joe Toscano.
And also a broadcaster on 3CR.
And a broadcaster on 3CR. So Joe told me the story of how he was blacklisted from his job as a doctor in Queensland and basically had to come down to Melbourne in response to that. So, the more things change, the more they say the same, I think.
Now, tell us a bit about your current research. Is that into high school students?
It's more ambitious than that. It's crazy. It's very ambitious. So basically I'm trying to write a book, and this is the benefits of being unemployed and living off my meager savings. So I'm trying to write a book which is on a broader history of youth radicalism and protest in the continent of Australia.
A particular time period?
Yes, the time period is very ambitious as well. The time period is from World War One to today, so it's crazy. To be fair, I'm only going to have a few, like maybe three chapters on the pre-Vietnam War 1960s stuff. So it kind of starts with Guido Baracchi is the plan, who Jeff Sparrow wrote a fantastic book about, Communism, A Love Story, which I'd recommend to everyone. And so Guido Baracchi was at Melbourne University, and he was possibly Australia's first student activist. He was involved in anti-conscription activism, and he was even – he debated Robert Menzies quite heatedly in the Melbourne University student magazines. And he was even dunked into the pond at Melbourne Uni by right-wing students. He was also dunked into a pond while he was in the UK. So he was a man of many ponds. So starts with Guido and then kind of goes into the 60s and 70s and then goes to like the period covered in my thesis and then the more recent protests like the climate strikes. Maybe got a chapter on like incredible call center worker organizing in Melbourne. And then like probably a final chapter on Palestine. I haven't quite decided how it's all going to look, but that's the gist of it. Yeah.
Exciting. And tell us a little bit about your podcast as well.
So I co-host a podcast, People's History of Australia. So I really recommend any listeners check it out.
I will put a link in the show notes.
Thank you. That much appreciated. So basically it's an attempt to like fill the gap in the left-wing history market in Australia. So people like I think know a lot about protests overseas like May 68, about the Russian Revolution, but there's a real lack of knowledge about collective action and protest in Australia. So we've compiled stories of like collective action and like collective action that won, you know, huge campaigns. So the first episode is on the Cortex strike in Melbourne in the early 80s with Sandra Bloodworth from Socialist Alternative. And it's an incredible interview about like, you know, the power of mostly of women workers at Cortex who were like mostly migrant women who'd never really been on a strike before. And they were able to defy the bosses for about a week, and they won most of their demand. They even beat their own union. They had a very conservative union who basically tried to rig the like union ballot to get them to go back to work without winning their demands. So that was an incredible story. Other stories like the Jobs for Women campaign in Wollongong, which took on the biggest company in Australia, BHP, and won. We have a fantastic interview with Patty Gibson on anti-Aboriginal racism and the struggle against it in the 1920s and 30s and kind of the key role of the Communist Party in organising solidarity with Aboriginal people and like organising mass meetings of white workers in solidarity. So that's an incredible story. We had Kelton Muir on about the Sydney College of the Arts occupation in the 2010s, which is kind of a lesser known story. But it was like actually the longest student occupation of an admin building in Australian history, over 60 days. Pretty incredible stuff. And Kelton is a natural storyteller. And that was a really fantastic episode as well. I think like one of the main things we wanted to do just broadly is we wanted to make it like an emphatically intersectional podcast, like intersectional, the buzzword of today. So we wanted to like not just focus on the stereotype of workers as, you know, blue collar men in factories. We wanted to look at like issues, kind of the intersection of race, gender and class. So the Jobs for Women story, which was mostly migrant Eastern European women, lots of Macedonians, was a real classic in that vein. We looked at the Wewa cotton shippers strike in the 70s, which mostly Aboriginal workforce, and was incredibly successful. And I guess the final thing was we wanted to do like the hidden histories that even people on the left, who are well versed in radical history might not know about. Like, so Wewa is like, I hadn't heard of before reading about it. And I've read a lot of history. So another one was Bob Borton's, discussion of adult education in the Communist Party. So some fantastic stuff that I'd like recommend all listeners to check out as an unbiased observer. And also I'd just like to mention that we're actually organising our first Radical History Festival, which is going to be in Sydney on March 15th next year. So if listeners want to have a day trip to Sydney, you should come up and check it out.
We could maybe have a discussion beforehand with some of the speakers and things, which would be fun.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Definitely encourage all publicity. It's a collective of, you know, two people. So we need all the help we can get. Yeah.
Excellent.
Researcher Tim Brightus, co-host of the People's History of Australia podcast. We'll go to a song now. This is Sydney band Coffin from their Australia Stops album, which came out in 2023. This is City Sun. You're on 3CR Summer Programming. Up next is an interview from mid-November when the Wednesday Breakfast team were joined in the studio by Mariotta from the Refugee Action Collective. And Mariotta was speaking about the ongoing campaign for refugee rights.
And now we are really pleased to be joined in the studio by Mariotta from the Refugee Action Collective. And Mariotta is here this morning to talk to us about the work of the Refugee Action Collective, the work that they're doing in the ongoing campaign for refugee rights in so-called Australia, including what's next now for the NARM encampment at the Department of Home Affairs. And that, as you will know, has wrapped up after 100 consecutive days of 24/7 protest. So, Mariotta, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the Refugee Action Collective. What is it and what do you do?
Yeah, Refugee Action Collective was founded in 2000. It's a democratic grassroots activist group. There are ones across the different Sydneys in Australia that work to fight for and defend the rights of refugees.
Yeah, really important work that is done by the Refugee Action Collective. 3CR has, I think, you know, come across some people at the Action Collective and obviously a lot of the organizers of the 100-day encampment. And so it's really, you know, good to be able to talk to you and hear what's going on after, you know, this encampment, which obviously was accompanied by lots of, you know, protest actions, I guess, you know, in a very structured way every Friday. And we know that there's been no response from the government as yet. So, you know, we really want to know what can we do next, but also really heartened to hear that, you know, RAC continues to fight with refugees in this space. So I would just would be really interested to hear from you about this ongoing campaign for these refugees that have been stuck in visa limbo, about 9,500 or so around so-called Australia. You know, what's been happening, especially following the closure of the NARM encampment, and, you know, anything else you might want to say about any political decisions that have resulted before and after this?
Yeah, of course. Well, firstly, it's a refugee-led movement. There's some absolutely amazing people whose lives have been drastically affected by this really cruel bridging visa system, who in this latest protest for 100 days camped out different politicians' offices. It started in Oakley, and then it went to outside the Office of Home Affairs in Docklands. And then refugee encampments sprung up across different cities across Australia and became this incredible national refugee-led movement. As RAC, we were just really proud and happy to support the incredible work that the refugees were doing themselves. So it for 100 days, 24/7, they camped out and protested, demanding permanent visas after a 12-year visa limbo. This is a group of refugees and asylum seekers who, for 12 years now, have been have not been awarded permanent visas and have been on this temporary visa system, which essentially keeps them in perpetual uncertainty. They don't get proper work rights. They don't get proper access to healthcare. From the outside, it maybe just sounds like admin, but it's an incredibly cruel system that keeps them in perpetual uncertainty. We have people who came here as children who have not been able to access university as a result. It's also predominantly affected people who are boat arrivals, often people who came from the same situations, but who were able to travel here by plane have been, because of Australia's clampdown on boat arrivals, living in this perpetual uncertainty. The protest went for 100 days and the campaign continues basically because nothing has happened. Did you want to ask a question?
I was curious, being up close with these people, with the refugees, as you have been, what's the sense of, or the mood that you get from them and their feeling about being stuck in this limbo?
My main feeling whenever I would talk to the refugees in encampments was huge admiration. Mm. These are people who often, they fled war zones or they fled persecution abroad, and they've come here and Australia has been so unkind to them for such a long time, but they just fight so hard for their children and for their communities and for themselves. So I was always incredibly impressed and inspired by them, but also incredibly sad for them. I mean, yeah. I don't like to paint this picture of like, oh, the poor, tragic refugees and we need to fight for them, because they're fighting for themselves and they're incredibly smart and impressive and strong people. They're people who have worked in this country for 12 years, who have grown up here, who have built communities here, who are just not being given like basic rights, and it's incredibly unjust.
And it's everything you say, Mariotta, and you know, just to sort of add to that, it is particularly you know, I think quite eye-opening to see the ways in which you know, Australia is arming Israel and involved in that creating of refugees in the Middle East, and has been, you know, in many so-called conflicts around the world. And so just, you know, it's also you know, I think that link between imperialism and refugees, I think often there's this framing that refugees should be grateful and, you know, or, you know, be grateful for this little crumb. But actually it's that it's exactly countries, imperialist countries like Australia, that create refugees. And so, you know, it is really particularly cynical to see the ways in which the response happens, but also the ways in which sometimes that discourse is really cut off from what makes a refugee, if you will, you know. Something particularly striking is that for these refugees in visa limbo, it really is visa limbo, as you say. So they have no corners to go to, no avenues for, you know, further recourse for appeals. And so they really are just can only stuck with appealing to this government that seems hell-bent on, you know, not responding to them. So can you tell us a bit about how the politicians have responded to the permanent visas campaign?
Yeah, of course. I mean, mostly the main thing to report was a non-response. And I mean, sometimes Tony Burke, the immigration minister, would come out of his office to speak to the refugees who were in camping just to tell them to stop making so much noise. Similarly, Julian Hill in Dandenong, there was a further encampment in Dandenong. Julian Hill, who's generally has a reputation for being a friend of refugees, again would discourage them from protesting. He made a statement that essentially put responsibility for this 12-year visa limbo on a previous Liberal government. When it wasn't Liberal government, it was a previous, it was a both Liberal and Labour. And they're trying to say, oh, look at all the good things that we've done for refugees. We're just not able to solve this problem. But in fact, they absolutely are able to sort out the permanent visas for those stuck. It's a political decision, and they're just choosing not to, like, they're just choosing not to be kind to them. They want to look tough on borders. To maintain this sense of Labour is tough on borders.
Well, I can imagine that'll come up again next year when there's an election on the way. You can almost guarantee it.
Every election, refugees are used as political footballs. The idea that refugees bring some kind of threat to the people who live here is completely fabricated.
And as you were pointing out a moment ago, it's people who have been contributing to this society, this country for many years already.
It's people who have people have communities here, people who have given so much to this country. One thing that really bothers me as well is when people talk about how they're so hardworking and they get so much to communities here, whereas there are so many people who were, say, born here or have citizens here who are like, who don't have to present themselves as hardworking. This idea that you have to bend over backwards and give absolutely everything to, like, get the prize of living in Australia is so unfair as well. Like, sure, they are incredibly hardworking and these people have given so much to communities, but they also fled from human rights persecution and they fled for their lives and like, their rights should be protected, their lives should be safe here.
Yeah, absolutely. I really, you know, as a migrant, really rage against these notions of, you know, what is good, you know, suggesting there is a way to be bad as, you know, refugee or migrant. And of course it is to, you know, conform and assimilate into the system just to create that othering. Now you're in the fold, but hey, there's still those other lazy bad ones on the other side, and so that's the new enemy. Can you join us in vilifying them? So it really is absolutely worth rejecting this discourse. And you know what you said really struck me, because you know, with regards to it being a purely political decision, because we know that there was the security guard in Sydney who, after I guess the Bondi attacks, I might be mistaken, was just granted that, you know, that citizenship was part of in this group of refugees in limbo. So all it takes is just a single signature. It does not take a change. It does not require a change in laws. It is not complicated. In fact, it's, you know, seems to be more complicated, if anything, to keep them in this permanent limbo. So really, I think the decisions of successive Labour, as you said, you know, and Liberal governments is, just does not, yeah, does not make sense other than really, you know, having an enemy for people to point to. You know, people know something is remiss, and so, you know, it's convenient to have an enemy. And yeah, you know, I guess it looks like it's going to be the refugees, but we keep fighting.
There was a development this week or in the last few days around some of the proposed legislation or changes, is that correct?
Yeah, in the last couple of weeks, bearing in mind I'm an activist and not a lawyer, in the way that I'll sum this up, but the High Court made moves to protect the rights of refugees regarding curfews and ankle bracelets for those released from immigration detention. In response, Labour have tried to rush through an incredibly brutal set of amendments to the Migration Act, which essentially, amongst other things, allows them to deport refugees to countries which have different human rights legislation to Australia, which puts them at risk of being deported back to these countries from which they fled. Like, they're putting refugees at immense risk of harm, first in offshore detention and then again in the countries which they fled for their lives from.
That's quite shocking. We would want to include details of this in our show notes. So this proposed amendment, do you have details regarding when it would supposedly, you know, be looking to go through and what we can do to stop it from going through?
Yeah, well, so the Labour are trying to rush it through because they know it's really bad.
It's getting towards that time of the year, isn't it?
Campaigning for refugee rights does have a history of making a real impact. As I said, like, RAC was set up in 2000 and it's continually made a real difference, along with the wider refugee rights movement in Australia. Regarding this bill, as well as continuing the fight for those stuck in visa limbo, RAC is continuing to campaign. We'll be rallying, we'll be educating. First I would recommend reading up on this bill. The Human Rights Law Centre released a really good breakdown of what the changes are. On December 10, RAC is hosting a rally for Human Rights Day, where we'll be talking more about this and marching on the streets to support them. It's also always, always worth writing to your local and national representatives. Our politicians are meant to speak for, doesn't feel like they speak for us a lot of the time, but that is their job. And if they know that their constituents and citizens are railing against something which they're trying to push through, then they do have to take notice. So we need to create as much fuss and as much noise and protest it and fight it as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely put that information up on the show notes. I just think the work that RAC is doing is really, quite key. And even to have this information is so difficult, you know, because we know that there's so much vilification in the mainstream media, you know, this being the political and cultural context. In what ways do you see that, changing in regards to how refugees are spoken about and thought of in Australia?
Well, refugees are vilified in the media. A really obvious outcome of that was over the course of the 100-day encampment, there were around 6 violent racist attacks across different encampments, and only 2 of those were neo-Nazis. A group of about 20 neo-Nazis coming with a big racist sign to, they may have been coming to violently attack the rallies, but there were so many of us that we fended them off. But these people and people with these far-right, extremely racist, I don't need to describe how Nazism is far-right, but like people with like extremely hateful views exist, because an environment is created in which those ideas are safe and welcomed to thrive in, and that is partly due to this environment that's created by the media and the politicians every election, where it's this this competition of cruelty, who can be tougher on refugees, who can be tougher on borders.
And you're seeing it from completely the opposite side, being up close to these people. It must feel almost like a privilege, really, in some ways, to be able to be a part of it.
Being part of RAC?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, totally. I mean, RAC, like lots of activism, is where we're fighting this thing which we feel very strongly about, but in the process we get the sense of community.
Yeah.
You can join RAC. We meet every Thursday, 6:30 p.m. at the Kathleen Syme Library. You can also follow us on Instagram. The handle is RAC_Victoria. It's a really wonderful community, and you're welcome to join us either at meetings or in our rallies.
You're on 3CR, it's New Year's Day. This morning we're joined by Davey Haller, a longtime NAM unionist, who is the co-editor and writer with online publication Class Conscious, that's classconscious.org. Davey has had articles on Australian and international politics published in Independent Australia and also with Pearls and Irritations. He joins us on the line. Hello, Davey.
Oh, g'day.
Thanks for being with us. We've also got freelance researcher Axel, who is a researcher in geopolitical economy and economic development, and we're discussing Syria with both Axel and Davey. Hi, Axel.
Hi, Monty.
Thanks for joining us. If I can go first to you, Davey, it's a complicated subject, Syria. It's been in the news a lot lately, and for many years, but specifically the last few weeks. Could you, to start with, just give us some history, maybe stretching back to the start of the conflict in Syria, so back to about 2011?
Yeah, okay. So in 2011, we saw the Arab Spring occur around the Arab world in West Asia. We saw rebellions and uprisings against many of the repressive governments of the region. One of those rebellions did indeed start in Syria, but unfortunately in the Syrian context it very quickly became militarized and turned into a combination of a civil war but also a war where many foreign powers became engaged very quickly. And it was a very bloody and destructive war for the people of Syria. some of those, America, the US, has made no, it's no secret that the Syrian government was on its list of governments that it wanted to see removed from the Middle East in its efforts to reshape the Middle East, as they like to say, since about the War of Terror, to replace the governments which are compliant with US foreign policy and for their control over the region. And the Assad government was one of those governments that wanted to see gone. So quickly, and also Turkey and other Arab powers got involved and backed various factions. And the Assad government was in deep trouble until it reached out to the Iranians and the Russians few years into the civil war, and that stabilised the military situation and reversed some of the gains made by the anti-Assad forces.
Yeah, actually, I might just jump in there, sorry.
Yeah.
David, you referred there to Bashar al-Assad. Could you, just for listeners, could you tell us just a little bit about his history?
Okay, so my understanding of Assad is that he's part of a ruling family that goes back about 50 years, the Assad family. His goes back to his grandfather taking power in Syria in a military coup about 50 years ago. And they came from a strain of Arab politics called Ba'athist politics. So people might have heard of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq as well. And it was a kind of strain of Arab nationalism where it wasn't socialist, but it was governments that came in under the banner of Arab nationalism and they were repressive governments like in Iraq and Syria, but they also did seek to use the resources of their countries to build up reasonable standards of living for the people in their countries. So, like Saddam Hussein, you know, no one's here to say the rule of Saddam Hussein was without repression, but before the overthrow, before 1991, the standard of living for people in Iraq and Libya and Syria and these places like that, before the efforts were made to free these countries, so to speak, by Western powers, their standard of living was a lot better than it is today. Mm. So the Assad ruling family were part of that tradition.
Mm. Now, Assad, of course, has just been removed, and we'll get to that in more detail in a moment, but he... his government was in power for many, many years.
So, yeah, since the 70s, since yes. the early 70s. I'll just quickly, just really quickly add that some of the opposition forces, it is worth noting, people would be familiar with ISIS.
Yes.
That was the jihadist forces which did manage to take over a large chunk of Syria during this period as well, and Iraq. And, yeah, so it's worth mentioning the role of jihadists because they're part of this story.
Indeed. As are Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebel forces which have featured in the news, as you referred to earlier. If you could perhaps tell us a little bit about HTS, please.
So HTS are a rebranded, it's a rebrand of a brand, a Syrian branch of al-Qaeda.
Mm.
So ISIS itself was a split-off from al-Qaeda, and HTS have had previous names such as the Al-Nusra Front, and they are essentially an offsplit of Al-Qaeda, who have been backed by Turkey, who has had they're the power which has had the closest relations with HTS. And HTS were the military force which recently captured Damascus, and which was precipitated the fall of Assad and his fleeing to Russia.
Now, before we get into the most recent events, and as you say there, Assad fleeing to Russia, you've referred there to the United States and briefly to Turkey. Going back a few years, could you explain to us and to listeners which countries have benefited geopolitically or which countries did benefit in the short term in this conflict?
With the fall of the Assad government in particular?
Well, primarily even going back, who was benefiting geopolitically during the last, we've been talking about since 2011, who were the benefits geopolitically in that period of time? So we're talking about the last 12, 13 years, first of all.
Well, the people of West Asia really suffer a curse of sitting on top of the world's most valuable geopolitical resource, which is oil.
Mm.
And that really shapes everything. You really can't understand the Middle East without understanding that fundamental point. And that's why we hear about the Middle East probably more than any other region on your news. You know, it's like it's not a huge part of the world, but we hear about it all the time because it's so geopolitically significant. In terms of the Syrian government, like I said, I think it's the U.S. has made no U.S. and its primary ally, Israel. They really benefit from, they're the two main powers which have benefited from the chaos going back now 25, 30 years, like I said, 1991, in the Middle East, which have just really destroyed one nation after another or undermined one nation, any nation which has, it's been seen to go against US and Israeli interests, has been targeted with sanctions and chaos. And now, so we see that three main countries, we see that. Four: Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Iraq are the four countries, and Lebanon, really five countries. So those countries have all had a hard 30 years, and the weakening of Syria and the attempts to overthrow the Assad government, for what of its flaws, has been part of the goals of Western imperialism. But countries like Turkey have their own agendas as well. Largely to do with their efforts to repress their own Kurdish population and to stop the development of a Kurdish national liberation movement in the area.
Just before we get to Axel,
the most recent events, the fall of the Assad government, what are the implications geopolitically?
So it's really early days
yes.
to say anything. Well, I mean, what can we say at the moment that the civil war, I mean, the people of Syria, I'm sure a lot of them are hopeful that the period of war has will finish, that the terrible displaced a quarter of the population and, you know, destroyed their economy under the combination of war and sanctions. However, the fighting is still ongoing in Syria. So since the fall of Assad, only a number of weeks ago, Israel moved in to increase the area of Syria that it's occupied. They had been occupying the Golan, most of the Golan Heights since the early 70s. Now they occupy all of that, and they have taken Mount Homan, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, which is a strategic site where for them to control or to wage wars against in the region. Syria has been a big, through its proxy of HDS, has increased its influence within Syria. But they're now fighting some of the US-backed Kurdish forces. So that's fighting that is ongoing. And Israel and America, but mainly Israel, moved after the fall of Assad to launch something like 500 massive bombing raids on Syria. And they have destroyed not just, you know, the West calls it Assad's military capacities, but Assad's gone. It was, after he left, it was Syria's military capacities have been, in the short term, completely decimated. So we all hope for the best for Syria, but at the moment the fighting still is ongoing, and Syria has lost its military defensive capacities currently. So, what the interim government at the moment in Damascus is led by the HDS.
There's a lot to digest here. Thanks, so Davey, appreciate that. Axel, if I could just ask, come to you for a moment. In terms of the broader, I suppose, global implications and the power struggle that we're seeing taking place in Syria, how does China fit into this?
Yeah, so the events in Syria and the speed with which they have unfolded nearly in 10 days, the whole government that has been in place for so many decades came to an end, just exposed a significant flaw in our understanding of the world becoming, like, in our understanding of the new multipolar order. And it is now exposed that the West, being a capitalist, imperialist structure that we're talking about, because we casually use the term imperialism about, like, any expansion of territory that we know in history to beyond the borders of a ethnic or linguistic group. But under capitalism, we are talking about imperialism in a broader sense of, like, transfer of value from the south to the north, which is a dynamic that hinders the development of the global south in the interest of the ruling classes in the north. So with that definition that I'm talking about, it's now exposed that the hope for this unipolar war that was that came after the end of the Cold War has not been at least very realistic, or it is not coming as soon as it was hoped for, it was expected for. The fall of Syria now denies Russia its privileged military position in the region, in the Eastern Mediterranean, and combined with the events in Caucasus and the Karabakh region of Armenia, or Azerbaijan, that Armenia had occupied but was under a truce by Russia. Russia has lost, while it's gaining militarily in Ukraine, it's losing in other areas, and also Iran being part of the Axis of Resistance to the Zionist project in the region, it's heavily now undermined geopolitically and in terms of its potential for resistance, because now we have a situation that this land barrier is technically cut between Iran and other actors in the region that were supporting it. So all this combined with the interest that the U.S. has in militarizing the East Asia and containing China, suggests that there is a that this multipolarity at least is not as close in the horizon that as some would have speculated before. And it means that China to become a balancer for the power of the Western imperialist bloc is probably having some limitations that has to be thought about. Well, we don't know as much about how Chinese think about this situation or what are the limitations and considerations, but it's apparently a situation of like these allied forces. The forces or the actors allied to China are being considerably undermined, or at least it's being exposed that they are more vulnerable than it was thought before, which means that China would be the next in this row, and the knife will be on their throat sooner than or later.
On the sort of world stage, do we expect to see China make statements about this situation, or is it very much behind the scenes when it comes to China? Because it's an enormous power play taking place in this part of the world, for want of a better description. And China, many people might wonder how and what role China can play. Do we expect to hear China say much about this?
That's a very good question. China has, like as you always have seen from China, has been very quiet publicly about how they view things. So really, I haven't across, at least not me, I haven't come across any indications that they are destroying any change in their direction or any reflections on how they would deal with this new situation or any even economic or any other move that they have decided to take. They are very close to this event, although that might be kept in mind. But still, it's very important to see if Chinese, if it's a wake-up call or if there's a lesson for Chinese in terms of understanding how willing the West or the U.S. is militarily to intervene in furthering its own interests. And this can also, it has to come to this kind of questioning or concern has to be expanded ultimately to India as well, because India is a very big player in the geopolitical game, and the next decade it will definitely define its own role, even though it's tailing China in terms of its economic development, but it's still given its geopolitical weight. It will be very hard to ignore how the interplay of these major actors will pose an opportunity for multipolarity if we see that as a positive development. These are very open questions to be seen, but it's just like it's probably important to keep an eye on how things unfold on those fronts. Let's put it that way.
We're with freelance researcher Axel, who specialises in economic development, and also with Davey Heller, who is co-editor of Class Conscious, the website classconscious.org. You're on 3CR. Davey, talking about China, India, and we'll get back to the US, but I suppose, how does Australia fit into this picture?
All right, well, just quickly before I get there, I thought it was just a little turn to an earlier point, briefly. Obviously, when I mentioned people and countries who were in the crosshairs of US imperialism, it was very remiss not to mention Palestine as a list of those countries.
Yes.
And obviously the context of the horrific 14-month genocide we're into, which has been conducted almost exclusively with weapons provided by the US as well. So, I just thought I'd better quickly, it's part of this picture and we hadn't picked up on that. So just but getting back to how Australia fits into this. So Australia, well and truly part of, we're basically a de facto member of NATO. It's no secret that our government, our ruling class, is completely aligned with Washington. You see them on the news whenever they talk about the international community. They use that funny phrase. It means the Australian government, the French government, the German government, the American government, and the UK government, maybe the Canadians, whatever, New Zealand. So that's that's who we're aligned with, the Western imperialists. And their interests overall benefit our government, and we're involved in that, and we're increasing our integration with those militarily with NATO and America, which was already high. So we had Pine Gap, we had bases, we had the ANZUS alliance, but now we have AUKUS, you know, now we have more, we have B-52 bases, planes in Darwin, we have soldiers based permanently in Darwin. So we're very much involved both in the conflict in West Asia, even though we haven't got a lot of soldiers on the ground at the moment. But for example, when Yemen, who has been firing missiles at Israel in response to the genocide in Gaza and being attempting to blockade trade with Israel through the Red Sea, it was a B-52 bombers refueled out of the north of Australia before and went and bombed Yemen. And all that data and things, Pine Gap's one of the most important military bases for the Americans in the whole world in terms of the information it gathers and sends back to all their precise weaponry, which targets people around the world. And we know that the Australian press, the Australian government is focused on the so-called threat of China. And so what's happening in West Asia now, as Axel said, is part of the efforts to isolate China. And that's part of what we're involved in our region. You know, every day it's, oh, we've signed a deal with Vanuatu or with, you know, with PNG to keep China out, keep China out. So we're part of that containment policy of China. We're part of the military build-up of the US against China and the open preparations for war, really, which are happening as we speak. So whether it be Ukraine, Syria, Taiwan, you know, this is a global struggle for power, and, like, you know, at which China is the greatest threat to US hegemony, and we are completely embedded with the US plans to try and stop that.
What are we likely to see in the immediate future when it comes to the change of government in the US in relation to Syria?
Okay, and it's a little bit hard to predict. I mean, I think, firstly, it has to be said that all Republicans and Democrats are completely united on the goal of U.S. foreign policy and military policy. Just a few weeks ago, they both passed in Congress the biggest military budget. I think it was well over $1 trillion, something insane like that, for the U.S. military. They're united that they're in the goal of the U.S. being able to dominate the whole world. That's the starting point. But that doesn't mean there aren't some differences between the Republicans and Democrats. We've seen that particularly over Ukraine. It seems like the Trump wing has been more open to perhaps doing a thing that conflict at least frozen, so that they can focus on the conflict with China or the tension building up and containing China. How that plays out in Syria, we're not sure. Trump almost went to war with Iran in his last weeks in office in 2020. Remember, he assassinated Soleimani January the 4th or something in 2020 and almost started a war then. He's he's incredibly pro-Zionist, like the Democrats. He's very hostile to Iran, who potentially are next on the list. Very close to the Netanyahu, the extreme Jewish supremacist government of Israel, rampaging around West Asia right now. How that all plays out is anyone's guess. Trump also famously said, I'll say, about the U.S. presence in Syria. He openly, unlike the Democrats, you know, who always talk in terms of human rights, Trump famously said, we're there for the oil. You know, I like oil. So that was his quote to those effects. So how that plays out on the ground in Syria and in the border region is a little unclear, all I can say.
In what's already been a highly unpredictable period of time over the last couple of years across the world. Axel, can I come to you on that sort of on that same point, the change, change of government going forward?
Sure. As David said, I see that continuity is more vivid in the foreign policy of basically every country than to consider like a drastic change with a change of government, especially in established first world or whatever way you call them, developed capitalist countries. There are already some indicators. You can read between the lines about the thoughts and ideas that are floated. So we have had on the news that Trump's one of the close assistants to Trump suggested already that there is a plan for normalization between Israel and at least 10 other countries during the term of Trump in office, and there is no way that Saudi Arabia would not normalize its relations with Israel. This has a lot to reveal in itself, I think, because, you know, Saudi Arabia has always been pursuing a military guarantee. And Saudi Arabia's weaknesses were very clearly exposed during the Yemen war, when after 8 years of war, they couldn't do anything about the rise of the Houthi government in Sana'a. And since then, Saudi Arabia has been begging the United States for proper military protection, which then suggests to us that this can be a privilege or a thing to exchange for in exchange for normalizing with Israel, which means that probably then we can imagine extension of military pact, whether it's NATO's expansion or a new, as it's been speculated, a new NATO or something to that effect, being extended to the region. It's also that I think it's very important for United States to remove as many cards from the table of Russia when it comes to the peace in Ukraine as possible. One important thing can be now that the military bases in Syria will be dismantled. Also, Iran as a bargaining chip should be removed. There is a big appetite to remove Iran as a possibility, also a geopolitical possibility for Russia to access south, because Iran, if not for anything else, is a very important, significant land bridge without any substitute between Russia and India. So this will be a good win if this possibility can be denied from both sides, both India and Russia. I think Iran, at the moment, the idea that is entertained is to talk about a new pact with Iran by the Trump administration, a new JCPOA or JCPOA 2, which is speculated to include not only the nuclear program of Iran, but also its other missile capability and other military capabilities. Mm. Iran is at the moment is a very geopolitically weakened position. It seems to me like a catch-22 situation in which the ruling establishment had not many cards to play with and not much choice. The idea of a negotiation with the U.S. Is most likely recipe for an overt defeat, but not negotiating or not normalizing is also the same. But that also has to be said that government that has been in the face of the United States for an excess of 40, 45 years is not something that the West is willing to really negotiate with. So a scenario like Syria or an implosion or undermining Iran's domestic stability through sanctions and embargo and added military or other forms of pressure is probably the most likely plan and scenario, and it's moving very quick from what I observe. So, yeah, the talk about normalization has also been extended to countries like Indonesia and Pakistan. I'm talking about normalization with Israel. If you put the whole thing in the perspective, then you would see like what kind of plans are being prepared to encircle ultimately Russia and China, because China is a true threat to the ascendancy and supremacy of the Western imperialist, United Western imperialist capitalist bloc.
Just use the word stability there. Davey, if I can come back to you in closing. Is there what is the sense of stability? Can we use that word at all in relation to Syria on the ground at the moment?
I don't know, in short. Look, I said many Syrians, you know, there were Syrians on both sides of the civil war since 2011. Many Syrians in Syria and people who have been forced out of the country, you know, are happy to see the Syrian government of Assad fall. But at the same, so I said, you know, like we all want the best for Syria, but at the same time, if we look at Libya, is a really sobering example of what can happen when a government is overthrown with the backing, in that case, explicit intervention of NATO, and jihadists take power. Libya has balkanized. It hasn't been able to have a stable government since 2011. It's a terrible standard of living for the people there. That instability spread to countries around Libya, particularly through jihadists getting weapons and being able to export their repressive chaos into other countries. I guess that is the risk that we face in Syria, the people of Syria face, is that ongoing balkanization, that ongoing battle for control of Syria, from regional powers, but also with the jihadists on the ground, and conflicting interests on the ground between the Turks and the Kurdish forces and American forces and so on and so forth. So it's early days, but I think the one word we unfortunately can't use for Syria right now is stable.
No. Look, I'll leave it there. Hopefully, going forward, it's a much better year ahead for these parts of the world which have had seen so much conflict. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Martin.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Martin.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's independent radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.